Come to the villages, and I will show you.
Luke felt his eyebrows go up. Right now?
Why not?
Sabaoth shrugged.
I have summoned a driver. He will meet us on the road.
His gaze shifted to something over Luke's shoulder.
No! Stay there!
He snapped. Luke turned. R2 had raised himself out of the X-Wing's droid socket and was easing his way along the upper hull. That's just my droid, he told Sabaoth.
He will stay where he is,
Sabaoth bit out.
Droids are an abomination. Creations that reason, but yet are not genuinely part of the Force.
Luke frowned. Droids were indeed unique in that way, but that was hardly a reason to label them as abominations. But this wasn't the time or the place to argue the point. I'll go help him back into his socket, he soothed Sabaoth, hurrying back to the ship. Drawing on the Force, he leaped up to the hull beside R2.
Sorry, R2, but you're going to have to stay here, he told the droid. Come on, let's get you back in.
R2 beeped indignantly.
I know, and I'm sorry,
Luke said, herding the squat metal cylinder back into its socket.
But Master Sabaoth doesn't want you coming along. You might as well wait here as on the ground. At least this way you'll have the X-Wing's computer to talk to.
The droid warbled again, a plaintive and slightly nervous sound this time.
No, I don't think there's any danger,
Luke assured him.
If you're worried, you can keep an eye on me through the X-Wing sensors.
He lowered his voice to a murmur.
And while you're at it, I want you to start doing a complete sensor scan of the area. See if you can find any vegetation that seems to be distorted, like that twisted tree growing over the dark side cave on Dagobah, okay?
R2 gave a somewhat bemused acknowledging beep.
Good. See you later,
Luke said, and dropped back to the ground.
I'm ready, he told Sabaoth.
The other nodded.
This way,
he said, and strode off along a path leading downward. Luke hurried to catch up. It was, he knew, something of a long shot, even if the spot he was looking for was within R2's sensor range. There was no guarantee that the droid would be able to distinguish healthy alien plants from unhealthy ones. But it was worth a try. Yoda, he had long suspected, had managed to stay hidden from the Emperor and Vader only because the dark side cave near his home had somehow shielded his own influence on the Force. For Sabaoth to have remained unnoticed, it followed that Jomark must also have a similar focus of dark side power somewhere. Unless, of course, he hadn't gone unnoticed. Perhaps the Emperor had known all about him, but had deliberately left him alone. Which would in turn imply...
What?
Luke didn't know, but it was something he had better find out. They had walked no more than 200 meters when the driver and vehicle Sabaoth had summoned arrived. A tall, lanky man, on an old Sora Sub recreational speeder bike, pulling an elaborate wheeled carriage behind it.
Not much more than a converted farm cart, I'm afraid,
Sabaoth said, as he ushered Luke into the carriage and got in beside him. Most of the vehicle seemed to be made of wood, but the seats were comfortably padded.
The people of Chainu built it for me when I first came to them.
The driver got the vehicles turned around, no mean trick on the narrow path, and started downward.
How long were you alone before that?
Luke asked. Sabaoth shook his head.
I don't know,
he said.
Time was not something I was really concerned with. I lived, I thought, I meditated. That was all.
Do you remember when it was you first came here?
Luke persisted.
After the outbound flight mission, I mean.
Slowly, Sabaoth turned to face him, his eyes icy.
Your thoughts betray you, Jedi Skywalker,
he said coldly.
You seek reassurance that I was not a servant of the Emperor.
Luke forced himself to meet that gaze.
The master who instructed me told me that I was the last of the Jedi, he said. He wasn't counting Vader and the Emperor in that list.
And you fear that I'm a dark Jedi as they were?
Are you?
Sabaoth smiled, and to Luke's surprise, actually chuckled. It was a strange sound coming out of that intense face.
"Come now, Jedi Skywalker," he said. "Do you really believe that Jorah Sabaoth, would ever turn to the dark side?"
The smile faded.
"The Emperor didn't destroy me, Jedi Skywalker, for the simple reason that during most of his reign, I was beyond his reach. And after I returned..."
He shook his head sharply.
"There is another, you know. Another besides your sister. Not a Jedi. Not yet. But I felt the ripples in the Force. Rising and then falling."
"Yes, I know who you're talking about," Luke said. "I've met her."
Sabaoth turned to him, his eyes glistening.
"You've met her?"
he breathed. "Well, I think I have," Luke amended. "I suppose it's possible there's someone else out there who..."
"What is her name?"
Luke frowned, searching Sabaoth's face and trying unsuccessfully to read his sense. There was something there he didn't like at all.
"She called herself Mara Jade," he said. Sabaoth leaned back into the seat cushions, eyes focused on nothing.
"Mara Jade,"
he repeated the name softly.
"Tell me more about the outbound flight project," Luke said, determined not to get dragged off the topic. "You set off from Yaga Minor, remember? Searching for other life outside the galaxy? What happened to the ship and the other Jedi Masters who were with you?"
Sabaoth's eyes took on a faraway look.
"They died, of course,"
he said, his voice distant.
"All of them died. I alone survived to return."
He looked suddenly at Luke.
"It changed me, you know."
"I understand,"
Luke said quietly. So that was why Sabaoth seemed so strange. Something had happened to him on that flight.
"Tell me about it."
For a long moment, Sabaoth was silent. Luke waited, jostled by the bumps as the carriage wheels ran over the uneven ground.
"No,"
Sabaoth said at last, shaking his head.
"Not now. Perhaps later."
He nodded toward the front of the carriage.
"We are here."
Luke looked. Ahead, he could see half a dozen small houses, with more becoming visible as the carriage cleared the cover of the trees. Probably 50 or so, all told. Small, neat little cottages that seemed to combine natural building elements with selected bits of more modern technology. But about 20 people could be seen moving about at various tasks. Most stopped what they were doing as the speeder bike and carriage appeared. The driver pulled to roughly the center of the village and stopped in front of a throne-like chair of polished wood protected by a small dome-roofed pavilion.
"I had it brought down from the high castle,"
Sabaoth explained, gesturing to the chair.
"I suspect it was a symbol of authority to the beings who carved it."
"What's it used for now?"
Luke asked. The elaborate throne seemed out of place somehow in such a casually rustic setting as this.
"It's from there that I usually give my justice to the people,"
Sabaoth said, standing up and stepping out of the carriage.
"But we will not be so formal today. Come."
The people were still standing motionless, watching them. Luke reached out with the Force as he stepped out beside Sabaoth, trying to read their overall sense. It seemed expectant, perhaps a little surprised, definitely awed. There didn't seem to be any fear, but there was nothing like affection either.
"How long have you been coming here?"
he asked Sabaoth.
"Less than a year,"
Sabaoth said, setting off casually down the street.
"They were slow to accept my wisdom, but eventually I persuaded them to do so."
The villagers were starting to return to their tasks now, but their eyes still followed the visitors.
What do you mean, persuaded them? Luke asked.
I showed them that it was in their best interest to listen to me.
Sabaoth gestured to the cottage just ahead.
Reach out your senses, Jedi Skywalker. Tell me about that house and its inhabitants.
It was instantly apparent what Sabaoth was referring to. Even without focusing his attention on the place, Luke could feel the anger and hostility boiling out of it. There was a flicker of something like murderous intent.
Uh-oh, he said. Do you think we should...
Of course we should, Sabaoth said. Come!
He stepped up to the cottage and pushed open the door. Keeping his hand on his lightsaber, Luke followed. There were two men standing in the room, one holding a large knife toward the other, both frozen in place as they stared at the intruders.
Put the knife down, Tom,
Sabaoth said sternly.
Svarn, you will likewise lay aside your weapon.
Slowly, the man with the knife laid it on the floor. The other looked at Sabaoth, back at his now unarmed opponent.
I said lay it aside,
Sabaoth snapped. The man cringed back, hastily pulled a small slug thrower from his pocket, and dropped it beside the knife.
Better,
Sabaoth said, his voice calm, but with a hint of the fire still there.
Now, explain yourselves.
The story came out in a rush from both men at once. A loud and confusing babble of charges and countercharges about some kind of business deal gone sour. Sabaoth listened silently, apparently having no trouble following the windstorm of fact and assumption and accusation. Luke waited beside him, wondering how he was ever going to untangle the whole thing. As near as he could understand it, both men seemed to have equally valid arguments. Finally, the men ran out of words.
Very well,
Sabaoth said.
The judgment of Sabaoth is that Svarn will pay to Tom the full wages agreed upon.
He nodded at each man in turn.
The judgment will be carried out immediately.
Luke looked at Sabaoth in surprise. That's all? He asked. Sabaoth turned a steely gaze on him.
You have something to say?
Luke glanced back at the two villagers, acutely aware that arguing the ruling in front of them might undermine whatever authority Sabaoth had built up here.
I just thought that more of a compromise might be in order.
There is no compromise to be made,
Sabaoth said firmly.
Svarn is at fault, and he will pay.
Yes, but...
Luke caught the flicker of sense a half second before Svarn dived for the slug thrower. With a single smooth motion, he had his lightsaber free of his belt and ignited. But Sabaoth was faster. Even as Luke's green-white blade snapped into existence, Sabaoth raised his hand, and from his fingertips flashed a sizzling volley of all too well-remembered blue lightning bolts. Svarn took the blast full in the head and chest, snapping over backwards with a scream of agony. He slammed into the ground, screaming again, as Sabaoth sent a second blast at him. The slug thrower flew from his hand, its metal surrounded for an instant by a blue-white coronal discharge. Sabaoth lowered his hand, and for a long moment the only sound in the room was a soft whimpering from the man on the floor. Luke stared at him in horror, the smell of ozone wrenching at his stomach.
Sabaoth!
You will address me as master!
The other cut him off quietly. Luke took a deep breath, forcing calm into his mind and voice. Closing down his lightsaber, he returned it to his belt and went over to kneel beside the groaning man. He was obviously still hurting, but aside from some angry red burns on his chest and arms, he didn't seem to be seriously hurt. Laying his hand gently on the worst of the burns, Luke reached out with the Force, doing what he could to alleviate the other's pain.
Jedi Skywalker,
Sabaoth said from behind him.
He is not permanently damaged. Come away.
Luke didn't move. He's in pain.
That is as it should be,
Sabaoth said.
He required a lesson, and pain is the one teacher no one will ignore. Now come away!
For a moment, Luke considered disobeying. Svan's face and sense were in agony.
Or would you have preferred that Tom lie dead now?
Sabayoth added. Luke looked at the slug thrower lying on the floor, then at Tarm standing stiffly with wide eyes and face the color of dirty snow.
There were other ways to stop him,
Luke said, getting to his feet.
But none that he will remember longer.
Sabayoth locked eyes with Luke.
Remember that, Jedi Skywalker. Remember it well, for if you allow your justice to be forgotten, you will be forced to repeat the same lessons again and again.
He held Luke's gaze a pair of heartbeats longer, before turning back to the door.
We are finished here. Come.
The stars were blazing overhead as Luke eased open the low gate of the high castle and stepped out of the courtyard. R2 had clearly noticed his approach. As he closed the gate behind him, the droid turned on the X-Wing's landing lights, illuminating his path. Hi, R2, Luke said, walking to the short ladder and wearily pulling himself up into the cockpit.
I just came out to see how you and the ship were doing.
R2 beeped his assurance that everything was fine.
Good,
Luke said, flicking on the scopes and keying for a status check anyway.
Any luck with the sensor scan I asked for?
The reply this time was less optimistic.
That bad, huh?
Luke nodded heavily as the translation of R2's answer scrolled across the X-Wing's computer scope.
Well, that's what happens when you get up into mountains.
R2 grunted a distinctly unenthusiastic sound, then warbled a question.
I don't know, Luke told him. A few more days at least. Maybe longer if he needs me to stay. He sighed. I don't know, R2. I mean, it's just never what I expect. I went to Dagobah expecting to find a great warrior, and I found Master Yoda. I came here expecting to find someone like Master Yoda, and instead I got Master Sabayoth.
R2 gave a slightly disparaging gurgle, and Luke had to smile at the translation.
Yes. Well, don't forget that Master Yoda gave you a hard time that first evening, too,
he reminded the droid, wincing a little himself at the memory. Yoda had also given Luke a hard time at that encounter. It had been a test of Luke's patience and of his treatment of strangers. And Luke had flunked it, rather miserably. R2 warbled a point of distinction.
No, you're right, Luke had to concede. Even while he was still testing us, Yoda never had the kind of hard edge that Sabayoth does.
He leaned back against his headrest, staring past the open canopy at the mountaintops and the distant stars beyond them.
He was weary. Wearier than he'd been probably since the height of the last climactic battle against the Emperor.
It had been all he could do to come out here to check on R2.
I don't know R2. He hurt someone today. Hurt him a lot. And he pushed his way into an argument without being invited, and then forced an arbitrary judgment on the people involved, and...
He waved a hand helplessly.
I just can't see Ben or Master Yoda acting that way. But he's a Jedi, just like they were. So which example am I supposed to follow?
The droid seemed to digest that. Then almost reluctantly, he trilled again.
That's the obvious question,
Luke agreed.
But why would a dark Jedi of Sabayoth's power bother playing games like this? Why not just kill me and be done with it?
R2 gave an electronic grunt, a list of possible reasons scrolling across the screen. A rather lengthy list. Clearly the droid had put a lot of time and thought into the question.
I appreciate your concern, R2, Luke soothed him. But I really don't think he's a dark Jedi. He's erratic and moody, but he doesn't have the same sort of evil aura about him that I could sense in Vader and the Emperor.
He hesitated. This wasn't going to be easy to say.
I think it's more likely that Master Sabayoth is insane.
It was possibly the first time Luke had ever seen R2 actually startled speechless. For a minute, The only sound was the whispering of the mountain winds playing through the spindly trees surrounding the high castle. Luke stared at the stars and waited for R2 to find his voice. Eventually, the droid did.
No, I don't know for sure how something like that could happen, Luke admitted as the question appeared on his screen. But I've got an idea.
He reached up to lace his fingers behind his neck, the movement easing the pressure in his chest. The dull fatigue in his mind seemed to be matched by an equally dull ache in his muscles, the kind he sometimes got if he went through an overly strenuous workout. Dimly, he wondered if there was something in the air that the X-Wing's biosensors hadn't picked up on.
You never knew, but right after Ben was cut down, back on the first Death Star, I found out that I could sometimes hear his voice in the back of my mind. By the time the Alliance was driven off Hoth, I could see him, too.
R2 twittered.
Yes, that's who I sometimes talk to on Dagobah, Luke confirmed. And then right after the Battle of Endor, I was able to see not only Ben, but Yoda, and my father, too.
Though the other two never spoke, and I never saw them again.
My guess is that there's some way for a dying Jedi to... oh, I don't know. To somehow anchor himself to another Jedi who's close by.
R2 seemed to consider that, pointed out a possible flaw in the reasoning.
I didn't say it was the tightest theory in the galaxy,
Luke growled at him, a glimmer of annoyance peeking through his fatigue.
Maybe I'm way off the mark, but if I'm not, it's possible that the 5 other Jedi Masters from the Outbound Flight Project wound up anchored to Master Sabaoth.
R2 whistled thoughtfully.
Right,
Luke agreed ruefully.
It didn't bother me any to have Ben around. In fact, I wish he had talked to me more often. But Master Sabaoth was a lot more powerful than I was. Maybe it was different with him.
R2 made a little moan, and another rather worried suggestion appeared on the screen.
I can't just leave him, R2.
Luke shook his head tiredly.
Not with him like this. Not when there's a chance I can help him.
He grimaced, hearing in the words a painful echo of the past. Darth Vader, too, had needed help, and Luke had similarly taken on the job of saving him from the dark side, and had nearly gotten himself killed in the process.
What am I doing? He wondered silently. I'm not a healer. Why do I keep trying to be one?
Luke!
With an effort, Luke dragged his thoughts back to the present.
I've gotta go, he said, levering himself out of the cockpit seat. Master Sabaoth's calling me.
He shut down the displays, but not before the translation of R2's worried jabbering scrolled across the computer display.
Relax, R2,
Luke told him, leaning back over the open cockpit canopy to pat the droid reassuringly.
I'll be all right. I'm a Jedi, remember? You just keep a good eye on things out here, okay?
The droid trilled mournfully as Luke dropped down the ladder and onto the ground. He paused there, looking at the dark mansion, lit only by the backwash of the X-Wing's landing lights, wondering if maybe R2 was right about them getting out of here. Because the droid had a good point. Luke's talents didn't lean toward the healing aspects of the Force. That much he was pretty sure of. Helping Sabaoth was going to be a long, time-consuming process, with no guarantee of success at the end of the road. With a Grand Admiral in command of the Empire, political infighting in the New Republic, and the whole galaxy hanging in the balance, was this really the most efficient use of his time? He raised his eyes from the mansion to the dark shadows of the rim mountains surrounding the lake below. Snow-capped in places, barely visible in the faint light of Jomark's 3 tiny moons. They were reminiscent somehow of the Minari Mountains south of the Imperial City on Coruscant. And with that memory came another one. Luke standing on the Imperial Palace rooftop, gazing at those other mountains, sagely explaining to 3PO that a Jedi couldn't get so caught up in galactic matters that he was no longer concerned about individual people. The speech had sounded high and noble when he'd given it. This was his chance to prove that it hadn't been just words. Taking a deep breath, he headed back toward the gate. Chapter 15.
Tangreen was our real crowning achievement,
Senator Bel Iblis said, draining the last of his glass and raising it high above his head. Across the expansive but largely empty headquarters lounge, the bartender nodded in silent acknowledgement and busied himself with his drinks dispenser.
We'd been sniping at the Imperials for probably 3 years at that point,
Bel Iblis continued.
Hitting small bases and military supply shipments and generally making as much trouble for them as we could. But up till Tangreen, they weren't paying much attention to us.
What happened to Tangreen? Han asked.
We blasted a major ubiquitrate center into fine powder,
Bel Iblis told him with obvious satisfaction.
And then waltzed out right under the collective nose of the 3 Star Destroyers that were supposed to be guarding the place. I think that was when they finally woke up to the fact that we were more than just a minor irritant. That we were a group to be taken seriously.
I bet they did,
Han agreed, shaking his head in admiration. Even getting within sight of one of the Imperial Intelligence ubiquitrate bases was a tricky job, let alone blasting it and getting out again.
What did it cost you?
Amazingly enough, we got all 5 warships out,
Bel Iblis said.
There was a fair amount of damage all around, of course, and one of them was completely out of commission for nearly 7 months. But it was worth it.
I thought you said you had 6 dreadnoughts,
Lando spoke up.
We have 6 now,
Bel Iblis nodded.
At the time, we only had 5.
Lando said, and lapsed back into silence.
So after that was when you started moving your base around?
Han asked. Bel Iblis eyed Lando a moment longer before turning back to Han.
That was when mobility became a top priority, yes,
he corrected.
Though we hadn't exactly been sitting still before that. This place is, our 13th location in 7 years, Cena?
14th, Cena said. That's if you count Warmrick and the Matry asteroid bases.
14, then,
Bel Iblis nodded.
You probably noticed that every building here is built of bi-state memory plastic. Makes it relatively simple to fold everything up and toss it aboard the transports.
He chuckled.
Though that's been known to backfire on us. Once on Lelmra, we got hit by a violent thunderstorm, and the lightning strikes were hitting so close to us that the edge currents triggered the flip-flop on a couple of barracks buildings in a targeting center. Folding them up neat as a set of birthday presents, with nearly 50 people still inside.
That was terrific fun,
Cena put in dryly.
No one was killed, fortunately, but it took us the better part of the night to cut them all free. With the storm still blazing all around us.
Things finally quieted down just before daylight,
Bel Iblis said.
We were out of there by the next evening. Ah!
The bartender had arrived with the next round of drinks. Twistlers, Bel Iblis had called them. A blend of Corellian brandy with some unidentified but very tart fruit extract. Not the sort of drink Han would have expected to find in a military camp, but not too bad either. The senator took 2 of the drinks off the tray and handed them across to Han and Cena. Took the other 2 off.
I'm still good, thanks,
Lando said, before Bel Iblis could offer him one.
Han frowned across the table at his friend. Lando was sitting stiffly in his lounge chair, his face impassive, his glass still half full. His first glass,
Han realized suddenly.
Lando hadn't had a refill in the hour and a half since Bel Iblis had brought them here.
He caught Lando's eye, raised his eyebrows fractionally. Lando looked back, his expression still stony, then dropped his gaze and took a small sip of his drink.
It was about a month after Tangreen,
Bel Iblis went on,
that we first met Borsk Phalia.
Han turned back to him, feeling a twitch of guilt. He'd gotten so wrapped up in Bel Iblis's storytelling that he'd completely forgotten why he and Lando had set off on this mission in the first place. Probably that was what had Lando glaring crushed ice in his direction.
Yeah, Phalia,
he said.
What's your deal with him?
Considerably less of a deal than he'd like, I assure you,
Bel Iblis said.
Phalia did us some favors during the height of the war years, and he seems to think we should be more grateful for them.
What sort of favors? Lando asked.
Small ones,
Bel Iblis told him.
Early on, he helped us set up a supply line through Nukov, and he whistled up some star cruisers once when the Imperials started nosing around the system at an awkward moment. He and some of the other Bothans also shifted various funds to us, which enabled us to buy equipment sooner than we otherwise would have. That sort of thing.
So how grateful are you?
Lando persisted. Bel Iblis smiled slightly.
Or in other words, what exactly does Phalia want from me?
Lando didn't smile back.
That'll do for starters, he agreed.
Lando,
Han said warningly.
No, that's all right,
Bel Iblis said, his own smile fading.
Before I answer, though, I'd like you to tell me a little about the New Republic hierarchy. Mon Mothma's position in the new government, Phalia's relationship to her, that sort of thing.
Han shrugged.
That's pretty much public record.
That's the official version,
Bel Iblis said.
I'm asking what things are really like.
Han glanced over at Lando.
I don't understand,
he said. Bel Iblis took a swallow of his Twistler.
Well then, let me be more direct,
he said, studying the liquid in his glass.
What's Mon Mothma really up to?
Han felt a trickle of anger in his throat.
Is that what Braelia told you?
He demanded.
That she's up to something?
Bel Iblis raised his eyes over the rim of his glass.
This has nothing to do with the Bothans,
he said quietly.
It's about Mon Mothma, period.
Han looked back at him, forcing down his confusion as he tried to collect his thoughts. There were things he didn't like about Mon Mothma. A lot of things when you came right down to it. Starting with the way she kept running Leia off her feet doing diplomacy stuff instead of letting her concentrate on her Jedi training. And there were other things, too, that drove him crazy. But when you came right down to it...
As far as I know,
he told Bel Iblis evenly,
the only thing she's trying to do is put together a new government.
With herself at its head?
Shouldn't she be?
A shadow of something seemed to cross Bel Iblis's face, and he dropped his eyes to his glass again.
I suppose it was inevitable,
he murmured. For a moment he was silent. Then he looked up again, seeming to shake himself out of the mood.
So you'd say you're becoming a republic in fact as well as in name?
I'd say that, yes,
Han nodded.
What does this have to do with Phalia?
Bel Iblis shrugged.
It's Phalia's belief that Mon Mothma wields altogether too much power,
he said.
I presume you disagree with that assessment.
Han hesitated.
I don't know,
he conceded.
But she sure isn't running the whole show like she did during the war.
The war's still going on,
Bel Iblis reminded him.
Yeah, well...
What does Phalia think ought to be done about it? Lando spoke up.
Bel Iblis's lip twitched.
Oh, Phalia has some rather personal and highly unsurprising ideas about the reapportionment of power. That's Bothans for you. Give them a sniff of the soup pot and they climb all over each other to be in charge of the ladle.
Especially when they can claim to have been valued allies of the winning side, Lando said. Unlike others I could mention.
Sina stirred in her seat, but before she could say anything, Bel Iblis waved a hand at her.
You're wondering why I didn't join the Alliance,
he said calmly.
Why I chose instead to run my own private war against the Empire.
That's right,
Lando said, matching his tone.
I am.
Bel Iblis gave him a long, measuring look.
I could give you several reasons why I felt it was better for us to remain independent,
he said at last.
Security, for one. There was a great deal of communication going on between various units of the Alliance, with a correspondingly large potential for interception of that information by the Empire. For a while, it seemed like every fifth Rebel base was being lost to Imperials through sheer sloppiness and security.
We had some problems, Han conceded. But they've been pretty well fixed.
Have they?
Bell Iblis countered.
What about this information leak I understand you have right in the Imperial Palace?
Yeah, we know it's there,
Han said, feeling strangely like a kid who's been called on the carpet for not finishing his homework.
We've got people looking into it.
They'd better do more than just look,
Bell Iblis warned.
If our analysis of Imperial communiques is correct, this leak has its own name, Delta Source, and is furthermore reporting personally to the Grand Admiral.
Okay, Lando said. Security. Let's hear some of the other reasons.
He's off, Lando,
Han said, glaring across the table at his friend.
This isn't a trial, or...
He broke off at a gesture from Bell Iblis.
Thank you, Solo. But I'm quite capable of defending my own actions,
the Senator said.
And I'll be more than happy to do so when I feel the time is right for such a discussion.
He looked at Lando, then at his watch.
But right now, I have other duties to attend to. It's getting late, and I know you really haven't had time to relax since landing. Irenez has had your baggage taken to a vacant officer's efficiency back toward the landing pad. It's small, I'm afraid, but I trust you'll find it comfortable enough.
He stood up.
Perhaps later over dinner we can continue this discussion.
Han looked at Lando. Such convenient timing, the other's expression said, but he kept the thought to himself.
Sounds fine,
Han told Bell Iblis for both of them.
Good,
Bell Iblis smiled.
I'll need Sina with me, but we'll point you in the direction of your quarters on our way out. Unless you'd rather I assign you a guide.
We can find it, Han assured him.
All right. Someone will come to get you for dinner. Until later, then.
They walked in silence for probably half the distance to their quarters before Lando finally spoke.
You want to go ahead and get it over with?
Get what over with?
Han growled.
Chewing me out for not bowing and scraping in front of your pal the Senator,
Lando said.
Do it and get it over with, because we have to talk.
Han kept his eyes straight ahead.
You're just not bowing and scraping, pal,
he bit out.
I've seen Chewie in a bad mood be more polite than you were back there.
You're right, Lando acknowledged. You want to be mad a little longer, or are you ready to hear my reasons?
Oh, this should be interesting,
Han said sarcastically.
You've got a good reason to be rude to a former Imperial Senator, huh?
He's not telling us the truth, Han, Lando said earnestly. Not the whole truth, anyway.
So?
Han said.
Who says he has to tell strangers everything?
He brought us here, Lando countered. Why do that and then lie to us about it?
Han frowned sideways at his friend, and through his annoyance, he saw for the first time the tension lines in Lando's face. Whatever Lando was reaching for here, he was serious about it.
Okay,
he said a little more calmly.
What did he lie about?
This camp, for starters, Lando said, gesturing toward the nearest building. The Senator said they move around a lot. 14 sites in 7 years, remember? But this place has been here a lot longer than half a year.
Han looked at the building as they passed it, at the smoothness of the edges where the memory plastic would fold up, at the signs of wear in the sub-foundation.
There are other things, too, Lando went on. That headquarters lounge back there. Did you notice all the decoration they had in that place? Probably a dozen sculptures scattered around on those corner ledges between the booths, plus a lot of light poles. And that doesn't even count all the stuff on the walls. There was a whole antique repeated display panel mounted over the main bar, a ship's chrono next to the exit.
I was there too, remember?
Han cut him off.
What's your point?
My point is that this place isn't ready to pack up and ship off planet on 3 minutes' notice,
Lando said quietly.
Not anymore. And you don't get this soft and comfortable if you're still in the business of launching major attacks against Imperial bases.
Maybe they decided to lie low for a while,
Han said. This business of having to defend Bel Iblis was starting to feel uncomfortable.
Could be, Lando said. In that case, the question is why? What else could he be holding his ships and troops back for?
Han chewed the inside of his cheek. He saw where Lando was going with this, all right.
You think he's made a deal with Phalia?
That's the obvious answer, Lando agreed soberly. You heard how he talked about Mon Mothma, like he expected her to declare herself Emperor any day now? Phalia's influence?
Han thought it over. It was still crazy, but not nearly as crazy as it had seemed at first blush. Though if Phalia thought he could stage a coup with 6 private dreadnoughts, he was in for a rude surprise. But on the other hand...
Wait a minute, Lando. This is crazy, he said. If they're plotting against Mon Mothma, why bring us here?
Lando hissed softly between his teeth.
Well, that brings us to the worst-case scenario, Han, old buddy. Namely, that your friend the Senator is a complete phony, and that what we've got here is a giant Imperial scam.
Han blinked.
Now you've lost me.
Think about it,
Lando urged, lowering his voice as a group of uniformed men rounded a corner of one of the buildings and headed off in another direction.
Gone, Bel Iblis, supposedly killed, suddenly returned from the dead, and not only alive, but with his own personal army on top of it? An army that neither of us has ever heard of?
Yeah, but Bel Iblis wasn't exactly a recluse,
Han pointed out.
There were a lot of hollows and recordings of him when I was growing up. You'd have to go to a lot of effort to look and sound that much like him.
If you had those records handy to compare him with, sure, Lando agreed. But all you've got is memories, and it wouldn't take that much effort to rig a fairly close copy. And we know that this base has been sitting here for more than a year. Maybe abandoned by someone else, and it wouldn't take much effort to throw a fake army together. Not for the Empire.
Han shook his head.
You're skating on drive trails, Lando. The Empire's not going to go to this much effort just for us.
Maybe they didn't, Lando said. Maybe it was for Phalia's benefit, and we just happened to stumble in on it.
Han frowned.
Phalia's benefit?
Sure, Lando said. Start with the Empire gimmicking Akbar's bank account. That puts Akbar under suspicion and ripe for someone to push him off his perch. Enter Phalia, convinced that he's got the support of the legendary Garm Bel Iblis and a private army behind him. Phalia makes his bid for power, the new Republic hierarchy is thrown into a tangle, and while no one's watching, the Empire moves in and takes back a sector or two. Quick, clean, and simple.
Han snorted under his breath.
That's what you call simple, huh?
We're dealing with a Grand Admiral, Han, Lando reminded him. Anything is possible.
Yeah, well, possible doesn't mean likely,
Han countered.
If they're running a con game, why would they bring us here?
Why not? Our presence doesn't hurt the plan any. Might even help it a little. They show us the setup, send us back. We blow the whistle on Phalia, and Mon Mothma pulls back ships to protect Coruscant from a coup attempt that never materializes. More chaos and even more unprotected sectors for the Imperials to gobble up.
Han shook his head.
I think you're jumping at shadows.
Maybe, Lando said darkly. And maybe you're putting too much trust in the ghost of a Corellian senator.
They had reached their quarters now, one of a double row of small square buildings, each about 5 meters on a side. Han keyed in the lock combination Sina had given them, and they went inside. The apartment was about as stark and simple as it could be, while still remaining even halfway functional. It consisted of a single room, with a compact cooking niche on one side, and a door leading to what was probably a bathroom on the other. A brown fold-down table-slash-console combo, and 2 old-fashioned contour chairs upholstered in military gray occupied much of the space, with cabinets of what looked like 2 fold-down beds positioned to take up the table share of the floor space at night.
Cozy, Lando commented.
Probably can be packed up and shipped off-planet on 3 minutes' notice, too,
Han said. I agree, Lando nodded. This is exactly the sort of feel that lounge should have had, only it didn't.
Maybe they figured they ought to have at least one building around here that didn't look like it came out of the Clone Wars, Han suggested.
Maybe,
Lando said, squatting down beside one of the chairs and peering at the edge of the seat cushion.
Probably pulled them out of that dreadnought up there.
Experimentally, he dug his fingers under the gray material.
Looks like they didn't even add any extra padding before they reupholstered them with this...
He broke off, and abruptly his face went rigid.
What is it?
Han demanded. Slowly, Lando turned to look up at him.
This chair, he whispered, is not gray underneath. It's blue gold.
Okay, Han said, frowning. So?
You don't understand. The fleet doesn't do the interiors of military ships in blue gold. They've never done them in blue gold. Not under the Empire, not under the New Republic, not under the Old Republic. Except one time.
Which was?
Han prompted.
Lando took a deep breath. The Katana fleet.
Han stared at him, an icy feeling digging up under his breastbone. The Katana fleet?
That can't be right, Lando, he said. Gotta be a mistake.
No mistake, Han.
Lando shook his head. Digging his fingers in harder, he lifted the edge of the gray covering high enough to show the material beneath it.
I once spent 2 whole months researching the Dark Force. This is it.
Han gazed at the age-dulled blue-gold cloth, a sense of unreality creeping over him. The Katana fleet. The Dark Force. Lost for half a century, and now suddenly found. Maybe.
We need something better in the way of proof, he told Lando. This doesn't do it by itself.
Lando nodded, still half in shock.
That would explain why they kept us aboard the Lady Luck the whole way here, he said. They'd never be able to hide the fact that their dreadnought was running with only 2,000 crews instead of the normal 16. The Katana fleet.
We need to get a look inside one of those ships,
Han persisted.
That recognition code Irina sent. I don't suppose you made a recording of it.
Lando took a deep breath and seemed to snap out of it.
We could probably reconstruct it, he said. But if they've got any sense, their code for getting in won't be the same for their code getting out. But I don't think we have to get aboard the ships themselves. All I need is a good close look at that repeater display panel back in the headquarters lounge.
Okay.
Han nodded grimly.
Let's go and get you that look.
Chapter 16.
It took them only a few minutes to make their way back to the headquarters lounge. Han kept an eye on the pedestrian and vehicle traffic as they walked, hoping they were still early enough for the place to be empty. Getting a close look at the repeater display would be tricky enough without a whole bunch of people sitting around with nothing better to do than watch what was happening at the bar.
What exactly are we looking for?
He asked as they came in sight of the building.
There should be some specialized input slots on the back for the full rig slave circuitry readouts,
Lando told him.
And there'll be production serial numbers too.
Han nodded. So they were going to need to get the thing off the wall. Great.
How come you know so much about the fleet?
Like I said, I did a lot of studying.
Lando snorted under his breath.
If you must know, I got stuck with a fake map to it as part of a deal back when I was selling used ships. I figured if I could learn enough about it to look like an expert, I might be able to unload the map on someone else and get my money back.
Did you?
You really want to know?
I guess not. Get ready. It's showtime.
They were in luck. Aside from the bartender and a couple of deactivated serving droids behind the bar, the place was deserted.
Welcome back, gentlemen,
the bartender greeted them.
What can I get you?
Something to take back to our quarters,
Han told him, giving the shelves behind the bar a quick once-over. They had a good selection here. There were probably 100 bottles of various shapes and sizes, but there was also a door off to the side that probably led back to a small storeroom. That'd be their best bet.
I don't suppose you'd have any Vistulo Brendali on hand.
I think we do,
the bartender said, peering back at his selection.
Yes, there it is.
What's the vintage?
Han asked. The bartender brought the bottle over.
It's a 49.
Han made a face.
Don't have any 46, do you? Maybe stashed in the back room somewhere?
I don't think so, but I'll check,
the bartender said agreeably, heading toward the door.
I'll come with you,
Han offered, ducking under the bar and joining him.
If you don't have any 46, maybe there'll be something else that'll do as well.
For a second, the bartender looked like he was going to object, but he'd seen the two of them having a friendly drink earlier with Bel Iblis himself. And anyway, Han was already halfway to the storeroom door.
I guess that'd be okay, he said.
Great,
Han said, opening the door and ushering the bartender through. He didn't know how long it would take Lando to get the repeater display off the wall, check it out, and then put it back up. On the theory, it was better to play it safe. He managed to drag out the search for a 46 Vistulo for a full 5 minutes. Eventually, with cheerful good grace, he settled for a 48 Kibshay instead. The bartender led the way out of the room. Mentally crossing his fingers, Han followed. Lando was standing at the same place at the bar where he'd been when Han had left him, his hands on the bar, his face tight. And for good reason. Standing a few paces behind him, her hand on the butt of her blaster, was Irenez.
Well, hello, Irenez,
Han said, trying his best innocent look on her.
Funny meeting you here.
The innocent look was wasted.
Not all that funny, Irenez said tartly. Sina assigned me to keep an eye on you. You get what you came for?
Han looked at Lando, saw the fractional nod.
I think so, yeah,
he said.
Glad to hear it. Let's go. Outside.
Han handed the bottle of kibshi to the bartender.
Keep it, he said. Looks like the party's been canceled.
There was an old 5-passenger land speeder waiting outside when they emerged from the lounge.
Inside,
Irenez said, motioning to the vehicle's aft doorway. Han and Lando obeyed. There, sitting with uncharacteristic stiffness in one of the passenger seats, Sina Lakevold Mydanil was waiting.
Gentlemen, she said gravely as they entered. Sit down, please.
Han chose one of the seats, swiveled it to face her.
Time for dinner already?
Irenez, take the controls,
Sina said, ignoring him.
Drive us around the camp. I don't care where.
Silently, Irenez made her way to the front of the vehicle, and with a slight lurch, they were off.
You didn't stay in your room very long,
Sina said to Han.
I don't remember the senator saying anything about being confined to quarters,
Han countered.
He didn't,
Sina agreed.
On the other hand, a properly brought-up guest should know better than to wander unescorted around sensitive areas.
I apologize,
Han said, trying to keep a sarcastic edge out of his voice.
I didn't realize your liquor supply was classified.
He glanced out the window.
If you're trying to take us back to our quarters, you're going the wrong way.
Sina studied his face a moment.
I came to ask you a favor.
It was about the last thing Han would have expected her to say, and it took him a second to find his voice again.
What sort of favor?
I want you to talk to Mon Mothma for me. To ask her and the Council to invite Senator Bel Iblis to join the New Republic.
Han shrugged. Was that why they brought him and Lando all the way over here?
You don't need a special invitation to join up. All you have to do is contact someone on the Council and offer your services.
A muscle in Sina's cheek twitched.
I'm afraid that in the Senator's case, it's not going to be quite that easy,
she said.
It's not so much a matter of joining the New Republic as of rejoining it.
Han threw a frown at Lando.
Oh,
he said carefully. Sina sighed. half turning to gaze out the side window.
"It happened a long time ago," she said. "Before the various resistance groups fighting the Empire were formally consolidated into the Rebel Alliance. You know anything about that period of history?"
"Just what's in the official record,"
Han said.
"Mon Mothma and Bail Organa of Alderaan got three of the biggest groups together and convinced them to make an alliance. After that, the whole thing snowballed."
"Have you ever heard the name of that first agreement?"
"Sure. It's called the Corellian Treaty."
Han broke off.
"The Corellian Treaty?"
"Yes,"
Sina nodded.
"It was Senator Bell Iblis, not Mon Mothma, who convinced those three resistance groups to agree to a meeting, and furthermore, who guaranteed protection for them."
For a long minute, the only sound in the speeder was the hum of the repulsor lifts.
"What happened?" Lando asked at last.
"To put it bluntly, Mon Mothma began to take over," Sina said. "Senator Bell Iblis was far better at strategy and tactics than she was. Better even than many of the Rebellion's generals and admirals in those early days. But she had the gift of inspiration. The knack of getting diverse groups and species to work together. Gradually she became the most visible symbol of the Rebellion, with Organa and the Senator increasingly relegated to the background."
"Must have been hard for someone like Bell Iblis to take," Lando murmured.
"Yes, it was," Sina said. "But you have to understand that it wasn't just pride that drove him to withdraw his support. Bail Organa had a strong moderating influence on Mon Mothma. He was one of the few people whom she respected and trusted enough to pay serious attention to. After he was killed in the Death Star's attack on Alderaan, there was really no one of equal status who could stand up to her. She began to take more and more power to herself. And the Senator began to suspect that she was going to overthrow the Emperor only to set herself up in his place."
"So he pulled out of the Alliance and started his own private war against the Empire," Lando said. "Did you know any of this, Han?"
"Never heard a whisper,"
Han shook his head.
"I'm not surprised," Sina said. "Would you have advertised a defection by someone of the Senator's stature, especially in the middle of a war?"
"Probably not,"
Han conceded.
"I suppose the only surprise is that more groups didn't back out like you did. Mon Mothma can be pretty overbearing when she wants to be."
"There wasn't any doubt as to who was in charge during the war either," Lando added dryly. "I once saw her make Admiral Ackbar and General Maydeen both back down on one of their pet projects when she decided she didn't like it."
Han looked at Sina, a sudden thought striking him.
"Is that why you've cut back your raids against the Empire? So that you'd be ready to move against Mon Mothma if she turned the New Republic into a dictatorship?"
"That's it exactly," Sina said. "We moved here to Peregrine's Nest just under 3 years ago, suspended all operations except materiel raids, and started working up tactical contingency plans, and settled in to wait for the Senator's triumphal vindication."
Her cheek twitched again.
"And we've been waiting ever since."
Han looked out the window at the camp passing by outside, a hollow sense of loss filling him. The legendary Senator Bell Iblis, waiting for a return to power that would never come.
"It's not going to happen,"
he told Sina quietly.
"I know that,"
she hesitated.
"Down deep, so does the Senator.
Except that he can't swallow his pride long enough to go to Mon Mothma and ask to be let back in."
Han nodded.
"So he gets you to ask us to..."
"The Senator had nothing to do with this,"
Sina cut him off sharply.
"He doesn't even know I'm talking to you. This is on my responsibility alone."
Han drew back a little.
"Sure," he said. "Okay."
Sina shook her head.
"I'm sorry,"
she apologized.
"I didn't mean to snap at you."
"It's okay,"
Han said, feeling some sympathetic ache of his own. She could have all the good intentions and logic in the galaxy on her side, but this probably still looked and felt to her like betrayal. A stray memory clicked. The expression on Luke's face just before the Battle of Yavin with the first Death Star, when he thought Han was going to run off and abandon them. "Han," Lando said quietly. Han looked over at his friend, shaking off the memory. Lando raised his eyebrows slightly in reminder.